Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
The gang here at Walks Will Hunt got a little bit of a break here at the All-Star break, in part because the Cincinnati Reds mostly got a break at the All-Star break too. The first place Cincinnati Reds, I should add. Alexis Diaz, major league leader in saves at the break, was the lone representative for the Reds, and he got a chance to go to Seattle and represent the team, got in the game as well. But the fact is, the biggest part of what has been exciting for the Reds throughout the course of the first half of the season, the youth movement, the rookies, the offense, the base running, the excitement, the newness altogether of what the Reds are right now, that's been on a couple-day hiatus. It's Thursday. It's the night of Thursday, July 13th. The Reds get back to action tomorrow against the Milwaukee Brewers, who are their their main rivals for the National League Central this particular season, jumping right back in against them three games at home after three games in Milwaukee to close the first half. And that's pretty much emblematic of what they're up against between now and the All-Star, not the All-Star break, the trade deadline, which comes up at the end of the month and effectively is the last, you know, 3 weeks the Reds have to A, define what it is they think is possible for this particular 2023 season, and B, perhaps more importantly, make the moves that they think are correct for maximizing what they can get out of this particular year. And the schedule's brutal. You know, let's be honest. They jump right back in with the Brewers. They play the Diamondbacks and the Giants and the Dodgers, and then boom, it's the trade deadline. So if they don't come out tomorrow ready to go, ready to play, things could get a little bit sideways on them quickly. So we're back. We're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about the Major League Baseball draft and Rhett Lauder and who else the Reds brought in that particular draft. And what we have to look forward to in the second half that, you know, not a lot of expectations were laid upon at the beginning of the season. So I'm Wick. I'm your host here at Walks Will Hunt, joined with by BK and Arf as always. And we're going to try to figure out what it is, where the Reds are and what they're going to be doing and where they're going to be aiming for things here in the next couple of weeks, because there are so many different scenarios in the course of a 3 week period of time that could dictate where they go with things. So we'll get to that in a minute. I think we should probably go ahead and just lead with perhaps the biggest news. It should be the biggest news. The Reds just added 20 players to their professional ranks, assuming they sign all of them, because the Major League Baseball draft happened over the course of the first few days of the All-Star break. Rhett Lauder, polished pitcher from Wake Forest University's seventh overall draft pick, a guy who I think a lot of people penciled in as a guy the Reds would be looking at number seven, given who else was on the board to start there. Arf, what are your thoughts on the Reds' move to take Lauder at seven and how that kind of set the tone for the rest of the picks they made throughout the course of this draft?
I loved the pick. The way things were going, you know, with the first five picks, I was worried because obviously Paul Skenes and Dylan Cruz were not going to be available, but kind of any one of Max Clark, Wyatt Langford, and Walker Jenkins were all guys who, you know, the Reds could have definitely picked and were very highly rated. And honestly, you know, probably could have been number one picks in a year that wasn't this year. And then so with everything kind of going worst case scenarios, the Oakland Athletics kind of threw us a bone and went with Jacob Wilson at number six, leaving really the second best pitcher, arguably, in the draft available for us. And, you know, he's a guy I've watched a decent amount this year. He was undrafted out of high school. He came out during the shortened COVID draft. But he was a guy who, didn't throw all that hard coming out. I think he was like a mid upper 80s guy with his fastball. And so he went to Wake Forest, who up until the last couple of years is not a college baseball powerhouse by any means. And with their, they have this pitching lab that they've developed with their biomechanics department, and they use that. And it's something that now a lot of college teams come and look at. Pretty much every major league team has been to look at and see what they do. And he went from an undrafted kid, not a huge recruit, to, you know, one of the best pitchers in the draft. And so I think the way that he came up, you know, having to rely on actual pitching and not just blowing people away in high school, I think is really helpful. You know, if you watch college baseball, you see a lot of these guys that throw upper 90s and hundreds, and they're just firing it away, but they can't hit the strike zone. And, you know, when they locate it, guys are going to swing, or because they throw that hard, guys are still going to swing at it because they, you know, haven't seen pitching like that before, and they're going to get strikeouts, but they also walk a lot of guys. Rhett Lauder doesn't do that. You know, he, and if anyone kept up with the College World Series this year, they played LSU in one of the best College World Series games ever. It was Lauder against Paul Skeens. And, you know, what you could argue that Lauder outpitched Skeens in that game. I think it took him 85, 88 pitches to get through seven innings against that LSU lineup, who, by the way, included the number two overall pick in the draft. So I was pretty excited when Lauder fell to the Reds, just because of what he can offer. He's polished. He's got a good fastball changeup combination. His slider gets people out, and he throws strikes. So I think for someone that you're looking to hope to be a fast mover, like he's kind of everything you ask for in a pitcher.
You know, it's interesting because, like, you know, Lauder not being drafted out of high school, Ty Floyd, their second first-round draft pick, taking 38th overall at LSU, also was not drafted out of high school. And, you know, it's interesting to see how that whole dynamic of scouting and college development is becoming more and more hyper-focused, especially with pitchers, because guys who, you know, either weren't quite ready as 18-year-olds or are becoming more polished at college programs than they ever used to be, and finding the ability to tap into more weight training and velocity addition than they ever used to be, are now becoming kind of A, the higher profile draft picks that they used to be, and B, guys who maybe professional teams view as guys who don't have as much mileage on their arms as they otherwise would, because, you know, let's face it, the high school arms that really get picked are the arms that are out there pitching enough for scouts to be able to take notice on. So it's just an interesting strategy. And Lauder, I get a lot of, you know, hopefully I get a lot of Sonny Gray vibes out of him. You know, he's a guy who, in one of his interviews, I know he mentioned that he learned how to pitch before he learned how to throw hard. And I think a lot of guys do it the reverse. They realize they can throw hard, and then it's time to start learning pitch sequencing and, you know, figuring out which part of the plate to pitch to and what other batter's tendencies are and things like that. It seems like the cerebral part of it came to him much, much earlier than his ability to throw a ball 95, 96 miles an hour. And I think that's a really cool aspect for what he brings to the table. And yes, also, as you mentioned, somebody who I hope is a very, very fast mover. It's a pretty good haul, and it's a haul that so far I think has been pretty well received. You know, two polished college pitchers in the top 38, guys who you think in theory should be able to move pretty quickly. It dovetails pretty well with what the Reds have in their farm system right now, doesn't it, BK?
Yeah, I'd definitely think so. And, you know, I think when you look at wasn't there one of the big, was it Jim Callis today who said that the Reds had his favorite draft or something like that?
He said the Reds had the best haul in the draft. I guess when he was ranking all the teams today.
Yeah, I mean, it was a great haul, but it fits where they are, you know, where the rest of their farm system is right now too.
And especially too, you know, you have all of these position players that are going kind of graduating at the top level, and you still have lots of position players here. But I think it is pretty significant that the Reds took, you know, four pitchers out in the first five picks. And you know what, three of the four are polished college arms that we'll probably move quickly up the system. So, you know, I like that, you know, Rhett Lauder, Tom Boyd, and Hunter Holland are probably all going to be fast movers. And, you know, I don't really...
We probably should have done an entire episode on Hunter Holland and just let Arf go off on him. I apologize for not scheduling that.
I can't believe you went through that first one without mentioning him. But
Anderson O'Donnell, by the way. Yeah. So.
Yeah. Well, I can talk about the rest of the draft, just kind of how they went. But yeah, the fact that they got an Arkansas guy and a Virginia guy in the first 10 rounds.
And shout out to Cody Adcock as well. Did mean to overlook Cody Adcock in the 13th round as well, also out of Arkansas. So,
The thing with
Will Scott and
Adcock with the transfer portal, both of them only played at Arkansas for a year. I think Adcock was at two other schools before he came to Arkansas. So it's kind of that this, you know, what people have seen in college basketball, you know, with the one and done is transferring over to college baseball and really all of college sports with the transfer portal. So I didn't really get to see Hunter Holland much. Adcock kind of got lit up this year. So
But the question we're all wondering is he at all related to Cincinnati Reds legends Nate Adcock from back in 2015 when he threw 13 games, 18 innings, and allowed 12 earned runs, 3 home runs, and a 1.50 whip.
That you knew that off the top of your head.
Right? I hope not.
I had to look up. I remember the Nate Adcock because I remember that he was part of the famed Red Goatee trio. He and Ryan Matthews and there was somebody else. There were three of them. You could never tell which one of them was pitching. Could have been Todd Coffey. Very well could have been Todd Coffey. So the draft is in the books. The Reds have done a pretty good job of replenishing a farm system that, obviously has been flush with hitting talent and needed a little bit of pitching talent. They did, you know, as much pitching as they have traded away, as much pitching as they have promoted, as much pitching has been injured, which is something we'll kind of touch on next. It was a very, very good kind of refreshing sign to not just see them add pitching. We didn't want to reach for pitching if that's not what the best available was at the time. But it seems like they got really good value for the pitchers that they added when they added them. And a latter, and Floyd specifically, they get two arms that should be able to move quickly with a team that's basically being driven by rookies right now and be very much a part of the same window that the Reds have opened in the first half by being the first place Cincinnati Reds as we start the second half of the season. And I guess that's where we segue here. We talk about the actual Reds and not the future Reds and figure out what it is they can possibly do in the next what? 18 days. The trade deadline is not July 31st this year. Is it the first or the second of August? I'm drawing a blank now. I know it's either the first or second of August, but given the gauntlet they're going to have to run against their schedule between now and the end of the month, and given who's still hurt in their starting rotation and what the guys who aren't hurt in their starting rotation have done and not done, they got to hit the ground running. They really do. There's no time to ease back into the second half and get guys loose and hope they don't slump for a couple days before they get going. They gotta show up ready to roll, or they could be very much 4, 5, 6 games back if things don't go their way to start the second half. So, BK, what is it that you hope? I mean, obviously we hope the existing Reds show up and just beat the crap out of the ball and Luke Weaver learned how to pitch over the break and everything starts to get better. But given the realities of what we saw in the first half, what do the Reds need to do over the next two and a half weeks to get this team from surprise first half contender to we're going to make the damn playoffs and we're going to be legitimate when we get there?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, just win games on this homestand, you know, come out of the gate hot, like you said. You know, I think this next series against the Brewers are probably going to be the most important games over the next month, just because it's going to set the tone for everything. I mean, if you lose 2 out of 3 out of that series, then basically you're leaving that series on a tie with the Brewers. You're facing two, you know, teams that are well above 500 right after that in the Giants and the Diamondbacks, still at home, but, you know, it's not going to be an easy homestand, but you know, that it's really a place where they can make a statement. If they take two or three of that Brewer series or take all three, I mean, they're really, the sky's the limit as far as what this team can do and the confidence that they're going to go into the rest of that homestand with. You know, as we've seen already, you know, this team definitely has a tendency to kind of live on streaks and all that. So it's, you know, I think if they can start a streak at some point here, that'll put them in a really good spot.
Yeah, 100%. And they are coming out of the second half with the guy who, you know, I've gone a number of different ways on how to kind of categorize this. And, you know, you don't have to categorize any of this. This is me going out of my way to just to twist my brain into pretzels that doesn't need to be in. But if you had to ask who the most important player was for the Cincinnati Reds during the second half of the season, at least who's on the active roster right now, it's hard not for me to say Graham Ashcraft, because Hunter Green is hurt, because Nick Lodolo is hurt, because there are very few obvious pitchers that the Reds could acquire between now and the deadline that won't cost a lot, in part because there are so many other teams out there who still consider themselves to be in contention for either a division or a wild card spot with the expanded playoffs the way they are. So without wanting the Reds to go out and unload the farm for most guys out there, and with rentals going to be in high demand and probably demanding more than they should, the Reds are probably in a position where they're going to try to ask some of their starting pitchers who are still there to get better than they've been. And when you look at what's in the Reds rotation, Ben Lively has been tremendous. I don't think we can ask more from Ben Lively. He has been a revelation as a number 3-4 starter coming back from the KBO and having been a fringe starter at all throughout his big league career. Andrew Abbott, by God, there's no way in hell we can ask more from him. I hope he maintains a fraction of what he's done so far at the big league level for now and for the rest of his career, and that will be a tremendous career. But you cannot ask him to be historically good, which he was basically through the first six starts of his career. I trust him, and I think he'll be fine, but you can't ask him to be the best pitcher in baseball every single day anymore. It comes back to Ashcraft for me, and he's going to start the second half against Corbin Burnes in Great American Ballpark. And he's a guy who at times has flashed brilliant stuff. You know, brilliant stuff. 99 miles an hour with a cutter. His arm motion is deceptive as all hell. He keeps the ball on the ground, which is a perfect recipe for Great American Ballpark. But he's also, as you mentioned, BK, been streaky. And his bad streak was just simply awful. Arf, what are your thoughts on seeing Ashcraft kind of getting tabbed as being the guy to lead them out of the second half? If that's a little bit of an endorsement almost from Derek Johnson and David Bell and the general manager saying, hey, man, we need you, and we don't just need you. We're going to need to get you as many starts as possible between now and whatever it is in August and Nick Lodolo and Hunter Green get back.
Yeah, I think, you know, looking at how he performed coming off the IL, I mean, giving up one run against that Padres lineup, even though they haven't been great this season, they're still pretty stacked. You know, he pitched into the seventh inning, almost through seven full innings, gave up only one run. And then I think most importantly that his most recent start, the game against the Nationals, like, if you remember, like, he started off shaky. Like, there were guys on base. Like, I mean, I think he left the bases loaded at least once in those first couple of innings, and
yeah.
somehow got six full innings out of it. I mean, he gave up seven hits, but he didn't strike out many guys, but he battled through it. Where in that rough stretch, like, if guys got on base, like, it was like a merry-go-round. So I think they were encouraged by that. And then I think, you know, also playing into that, you know, when the previous Brewer series, you know, Andrew Abbott started game one against Corbin Burnes. That was Abbott's second time facing the Brewers this season. And they obviously scouted him, and you could tell, like, they were getting a hold of pitches, that they weren't getting a hold of, you know, that first time. I think it was his debut when he started against them the first time. So I think letting him get that second game of the series, I think, will help him a little bit more mentally. Actually seeing the Brewers again for that, you know, after the All-Star break, watching Ashcraft pitch against them, not having to face off against their former Cy Young winner, and then, you know, it'll kind of be interesting to see how they adjust to pitching to a team that obviously scouted him last time.
For sure. You know, it kind of dawned on me after the fact, you know, talking about some of Ash Crash's struggles, despite the fact that he's got some of the more electric stuff that we've seen in the game. He's almost the inverse of Rhett Lauder, new first round pick of the Reds, in that the stuff's there and he's still trying to work out how to pitch it, how to command it, you know, how to sequence it, how to approach certain batters, how to find the consistency there. Because when he's dialed in and when he gets that part right, which he has at times, he certainly did to start this season. I mean, he was the best pitcher on the Reds to start this season, and that's when Lodolo and Green were healthy. So I think the Reds are not just, you know, making sure that they've got everybody lined up on good rest and ready to go to start this second half. To me, I take this as a literal endorsement for Graham saying, look, we need you. We're going to have you as a very, very big part of this, and we're going to make sure you get the absolute most number of starts between now and when the reinforcements get here. BK, the question is, though, do they go out and find more reinforcements? And if they do, do they do it in the one spot that we all know has been the most glaring need for them, which is in the starting rotation?
Yeah, I mean, I think that they still will, but – you know, I don't really feel like there's that sense of urgency that I think we all want. You know, I think, you know, as a fan who's, you know, watching every game and living and dying with the team, you know, watching every night, we always want these changes immediately. And we know that that's, you know, it's, they're going to look for the best deal. Nick Kroll is not a reactionary type of GM. He's not going to go in for a deal that isn't the right deal. So, you know, I do still see them making a move. I think it'll be a lot longer from now, like a lot closer to the deadline, if not on the deadline day. But you know, I think that I think David Bell's probably telling them the same thing. Like, you know, it's not like people, you know, the front office can't see that the guys that they're putting on the roster and running out there, right? Like, There is a full rotation spot where there are, or rotation and bullpen spot where there's just, it's just been a rotating door of guys from Louisville who they call them up, they get into the game, they DFA them, they clear waivers, go back to Louisville.
Go completely unclaimed. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, and it's just, you know, constantly switching out that spot. And it's like, you know, everyone is aware of that going on. It's just a matter of, you know, they got to find the right deal to get the right guy. And hopefully they'll make that change and get these guys some help.
I mean, they're not giving up Connor Phillips for a rental. They're not giving up CES for a rental. They're not giving new LV Martia for a rental. And that's basically what the prices are for the high profile rental arms on the teams that are obvious sellers right now, because there are so few obvious sellers right now. And if I was the White Sox and I had Lance Lynn and Lucas Giolito, that's absolutely what the hell I'd be asking for right now, because it doesn't matter to them if they hold on to him for another 2 weeks. Yeah. It doesn't matter what bit.
Right now, that's the market. That's they're the market. So
it's a seller's market. I don't fault them for that. But I also don't want Nick Kroll to bite that hook just yet, despite the fact that either of those guys could go a long way towards helping this team be legitimate. I don't want them to give up more than they should. And the ask right now is way more than it should be, which, more power to them. They're not going to get it. That's why those deals haven't been made by anybody just yet. So, I think it's, you know, it's funny to see how that plays out, especially, I mean, and I'm not saying there's not some whiteboard up there that says in the Reds locker room every day, Luke Weaver's the guy that we need to upgrade from. So you guys must help Luke Weaver more than anybody else. You know, everybody's hands in, 1, 2, 3, go Reds. Like, there's not that going on right now. But it does crack me out that Weaver has been the worst pitcher the Reds have had all year. He's been worse than Jason Marquis was when the Reds signed Jason Marquis. He's been bad. He's been bad. He's been as bad as Bronson Arroyo's, you know, swanson second stint with Cincinnati. But for whatever reason, whenever he pitches, the Reds go out and score 9 runs. And they've won. They just keep winning games Luke Weaver starts. It's almost as if the clubhouse kind of knows who they have to pick up and they're finding ways to pick up the guys that need picking up. And that's kind of the way that I think I could describe this particular team, is that they're picking up guys that need picking up. They don't bitch when they're getting platooned, and Joey Votto's getting platooned. You know, like Joey Votto's literally getting platooned most of the time. It's fine. He's not saying anything, and it's working out. Like, it's the right move, it's the right call. They're getting contributions from everybody every single night. It's a team that almost realizes that for the time being, they're going to have to punch bigger than their weight because nobody gave them credit for it. And until they find, you know, a present underneath the Christmas tree, when they walk in the next morning, they're not expecting anybody to be there helping them. And that's not an indictment on Nick Kroll. I don't want him to freak out and make moves sooner than he should be. But it seems like this team's like, screw it. This is what we got. We're going to win with it. And they've been finding ways. And I think that gives Kroll a little bit more leeway to be patient with what the market's setting right now than it otherwise would be if every fourth day Luke Weaver went out there, gave up 9 runs, and the Reds lost 9-1, you know? And so just the dynamic of how that's shaken out, I think, is as much what's going to give him the patience to make the right targeted move as opposed to a panic move. And that's a good thing. That's a very, very good thing. All we can do is hope that it continues. And the Reds can pick that up from the second half and not miss a beat going forward. I guess the last thing we can just kind of throw out there, since it's the second half of the season starting tomorrow, is biggest second half storylines. I've got a couple in my mind that I think are pertinent, but I guess I'll let you guys lead off. What's a big second half storyline that you're going to be watching for when the Reds get back to playing tomorrow?
I think the main thing is BK kind of mentioned it earlier, is like how this team lives on streaks, and if, you know, given the schedule that they have, if the break doesn't mess that up. You know, sometimes you can get into a groove on things, and it's just like, all right, we're just winning, we're scoring a bunch of runs, we're playing this awesome style, and we're just on a roll, and then, all right, now we're off for 4 days. Like, do they pick it up that quickly getting back after the All-Star break?
Yeah, because, I mean, like, nobody's really slumped yet. Like, honestly, like,
right.
There have been very few, like, mini, you know, over 11 kind of slumps, but nobody's really been, like, bad slump yet out of this entire team.
And I think, like, the, you know, the second thing, and like, let's say things don't get off to a great start after the break. Does the front office continue to say, look, this is what this team is capable of. We saw it in the first half. Do we still go out and get the starting pitcher that they need, or get the bullpen help that they need to help them turn it around? Or do they say, all right, we're going to pull the plug on it, play for 2024, which I think would go a long way to pissing off a lot of people. But, you know, that's I'm interested to see if this, you know, if they go out and go like 2-7 in their first, you know, those first three series, what the front office does. And especially if the Brewers keep winning, you know, throughout that stretch. So those are kind of my immediate storylines that I'm keeping an eye on.
BK, how about you, Ben? What's your go-to second half storyline to watch?
I mean, I definitely think Arf hit the nail on the head, just with, like, if, you know, I think even just the last thing you said, like, if, like, what if 2 weeks from now the Brewers are 5 games up in the division and you know, the Reds are tied with the Cubs for third place or something, you know, what happens then as far as buying and selling, and what does Nick Kroll do at that point? You know, does he still commit to buying and trying to win this year or not? Or, you know, do they kind of punt and try and go for 2024 and just kind of go from there? But, you know, I think that to me, the thing that is going to be the biggest thing is all of these rookies, and are they going to be able to keep up? And, you know, I feel like this team is just so, like, it runs on vibes so much that, like,
yes, yes. You know,
if, hey, what if, you know, you have a couple of days where, okay, Matt McClain's not hitting, Ellie's not hitting, Steer's not hitting, Jonathan Andy is not hitting. Well, what happens then if that happens for four games in a row? And does the rest of the team just kind of collapse around it? You know, so far we've seen that, you know, unsung guys have been able to kind of like rally around and take up for that and pick up the slack. But usually that's only if, you know, you got one or two guys that are struggling, you know, for one game. You know, it's not really, we really haven't seen any of these rookies have that adversity that really every rookie generally has, right? You know, you look at Jonathan India, won the Rookie of the Year award his first year, came back and had his kind of sophomore slump. And, you know, it's like, does Spencer Steer start to get that in September? Does the league start figuring out Ellie? You know, I can't imagine that that's going to be the case, but you know, it definitely is. It will go a long way to dictate what the Reds do as far as winning ball games.
Yeah. I mean, let's be honest, for as bad as the NL Central is right now, the Reds still aren't in a great position, you know, to necessarily take home a wild card spot if things don't go right the next couple of days. Like, their clearest path to making the postseason is to knock the Brewers in the teeth, and the six times they play them between now and the deadline, say this is the dividing line between us and them, and then we make the moves that make us even better than we were when we beat them as much as we did over that six-game stretch and put that distance in there. So, you know, it's a second-half storyline, but it's the next 2.5 weeks storyline, which in reality, if you think about it, if you make the playoffs in October, you get about 2.5-3 weeks of really high pressure baseball where you find out if you're better than the other teams or competitive with the other teams around you. And that's what the postseason is. This is a mini postseason right now. The Reds are almost playing to see if they deserve to play meaningful baseball past July, you know, and they're going to have to win their way into making the last 2+ months of baseball memorable and tangible, or practice for a future season again. And it's a lot of, you know, hyperbole to kind of put that on there. But at the same point in time, they're on the cusp of making it that. And the good teams out there, even the teams that are on the cusp of making their own playoffs, teams like the Yankees, teams like the Boston Red Sox, they're going to try to get better right now also. They're going to do everything they can to get better players too. So it's certainly a hyper spotlight on the next couple weeks. And that for me is probably storyline A as we start the second half. But storyline B is one that I think is a little bit more nostalgic for me. And that's Joey Votto. And it's a guy who's got the same OPS as Shohei Ohtani right now, obviously in a much smaller a sample size since he finally returned from injury, but a guy who looks like the 2021 Joey Votto, who had a swing change and rediscovered how to knock the living shit out of the ball. And it's his last season under guaranteed contract. And he's playing like, not only does he deserve to have the option that the Reds have on him for next year at $20 million with a $7 million buyout. So effectively, he's playing for $13 million guaranteed from the Reds, or the ability to take $7 million from them to hit free agency. But he's playing well enough for somebody to sign him next year. I mean, he's going to be playing Major League Baseball next year. He's not retiring. This is not his swan song. The question is whether or not this is his Reds swan song. And A, what that does to his production down the stretch. And B, how intimately he might take any decision by the front office to go for it this year or not, a little bit more personally than any other player in the dugout. And I would probably empathize with him either direction he takes. And I will preface that by saying I don't expect whichever direction he personally takes to ever become public, because he doesn't seem like the kind of guy who would ever make that kind of emotion public. But, you know, the reality is that we could be watching the last little bit of Joey Votto as a Cincinnati Red. And that happens to dovetail with them being firmly in the thick of it, I think is going to do nothing but just absolutely elevate his game. Arf, what are your thoughts on where the Reds and Votto stand after the last, what, you know, seven home runs and 20-ish games he's been back, where he's looked like the Joey Votto that we've come to love over the last 15 years in Cincinnati.
Yeah. I mean, I, you know, when we were podcasting back in the spring, you know, I think I said, like, look, I don't know how he comes back from an injury like this. I mean, that surgery ruins a lot of 29-year-olds' careers.
Yeah.
And he's 39 and trying to come back from a surgery like that. I mean, a rotator cuff surgery is a big deal. And the fact that he's coming back and hitting the ball this hard, I mean, it's not like he's spraying singles like across the diamond, like he's killing the ball. And so it's obvious that he has a strength back. He still sees the ball well. He's still walking. And I mean, he's getting on base. He's still doing everything that we remember Joey Votto doing. But I think most importantly is like his role off of the field. You know, they keep cutting the shots of him going over pitches with Ellie in the dugout. You see him getting pinch hit for in high leverage situations, and he's standing on the top step of the dugout, you know, watching Jonathan India try and win a ball game. So I think, like, regardless of what the Reds do this year and the next, especially in the next 2 weeks, and like how they approach that, like, you know, I think you do what you can to keep him for everything outside of the field alone, or what he does on the field alone. Like, he's obviously very important to what, like, to all these rookies, and he's such a good, like, mentor and, you know, just such a good veteran influence in the dugout, that I think that's worth picking up the option. Cause we may not see that kind of production out of him next year, but I mean, I'm going to say this, and he's going to hit 40 home runs next year because I said that's what he did after what I said in the spring. But yeah, I think if the Reds are serious about, like, all right, this is our window, we have to bring these young guys along and make sure that they know what it's like to play in the playoffs, because, I mean, it's been forever, but Joey Votto has done it. Then I think he's worth having, you know, spending that, what, 24 million or whatever it is to pick it up.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, is like, there's so many rookies in the roster right now who, not that they don't want to go to the playoffs, but it'd be hard for them not to admit that the idea of just being in the big leagues and playing every day was the first thought that they have come to their mind every single day, as opposed to win this game, are we in first place, make the playoffs. You know, like, it's a transition you have to make from being there, being in the moment, to looking at the bigger picture. I can't imagine there's anybody in that dugout who wants to get back to the goddamn playoffs more than Joey Votto. You know, and as if a team of good young players needed any more motivation, the dude coming back from this giant double surgery, batting sixth as a future Hall of Famer and knocking the living shit out of the ball. Like, that's like, it's that fun uncle that they got that showed up and can ball. And it's such a vital, vital part of this team this year, but it's almost like he's doing everything he possibly can to say, I don't want to just be a part of this team this year. I want to be a part of this team next year. And shit, maybe even beyond that. I mean, Nelson Cruz just finally got DFA'd at what, 43? Like, BK, it sure as heck seems like Votto's not just showcasing himself for the rest of baseball. He's showcasing himself that he should be a Cincinnati Red some more, and these Reds are still going somewhere this year and beyond.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it definitely seems like he did the right thing by waiting until, you know, late June to start actually playing and contributing, and he kind of has found his place on this roster. And it's really cool to see all of the people who were, you know, wondering how he was going to fit in, and, oh, if he doesn't hit, what are they going to do with him? Are they going to bench him? It's like, no, he stepped on, he is helping this team in so many different facets, whether that's, you know, as you said, the mentorship of the other guys, or even just socking dingers in the lineup. It's like, you know, I think that he is trying to prove himself to the front office to pick up that option and show the value he has here, only because, you know, he's more valuable to the Reds than he is any other team. You know, he could go somewhere else and he could hit the way he's hitting and have value, but he doesn't have that. He's not going to have that same relationship with the city. He's not going to have that same relationship with the players that are already there. And the young guys that, you know, he's bonding with this year, I think that if it's not in the cards for the Reds to be a playoff team this year, I'm interested to see, like, I think that he'll want to be part of this, you know, for another year going forward. But it's really up to the Reds to do the right thing there, right?
Let's be like, Votto is this is me being generous here. Votto's a lot like us. Like, he's been with the Reds for a long damn time. Like, he's a fan of this franchise and a fan of this city, and he wants to see them win, and he wants to be a part of that. Like, he doesn't want to go to Baltimore or Toronto or somewhere else next year for an extra couple million bucks. Like, let's be honest, at this point in his career with what he's made, like, that shouldn't be the defining factor. It's clear, and it's been clear, that he wants this team to be good. That's why he stuck around as long as he has. And he's helping them be good and thinks he still can, and is just begging for the front office and the ownership to take notice. It's admirable. Like, to me, it's admirable as can be that he's in the position where he's a 39-year-old dude who's going to turn 40 later this year and finally has the kind of dynamism around him to where he can play not just the lone shining star role, but, like I said, the fun uncle role, which is still a vital role to this team, perhaps the most vital role to this team, and see it materialize in more than just a one-year flash in the pan kind of way.
Yeah, when I was kind of talking about that, it's almost like he's playing like that Scott Rolen role of 2009, 2010, mm-hmm. because that 2010 run, it was, you know, Joey Votto and Jay Bruce and all those guys, even though they weren't rookies at the time, like, they hadn't experienced a winning team, and they were navigating life as like, oh, okay, now we're not just major league players. We're trying to win a division and make the playoffs. And, you know, he's kind of taken on that role now, except he's been with the organization a long time instead of getting picked up a year ago. I don't know, that's kind of the comparison that just popped in my head as we were
talking. It's a like tremendous one.
That's been his role. And what's been the most impressive about it is, like,
so you should write about that for redreporter.com.
I'll do that. But what's most impressive is, like, he goes to Louisville, and I don't know if anyone follows him on social media. I remember seeing he posted something where he's in the locker room before a game or during a rain delay or something. He's playing chess with one of the other guys on the team, and Matt McClain comes over and, like, tosses the board and, like, ruins their game and, like, rubs Votto's head and, like, runs away or something. It's like, he was with Louisville for like 2 weeks, and he's got guys like playing pranks on him and stuff like that. Like, that's how comfortable these guys felt around someone who was a former MVP, should have been a 2-time MVP. And then he realizes, okay, I can't hit the ball like I want to. I'm not at the place where I want to. I'm going to pull back my rehab. He travels with the team and does his rehab on the road, basically. Like, he sees the potential this team has. And instead of, like, staying in Cincinnati or going down to Arizona and, like, just staying away, he's like, no, I need to be a part of this, and I need to play this role with this team. And so, I mean, it's not like he just joined and is like, all right, hey guys, what's going on? Like, he's been with them the whole time, just not playing. And then now that he's playing, he's, you know, having that influence on the field instead of just off of it.
Like what do you think the reaction would be if, like, you know, we're waiting around for the tweets to come out for the lineups tomorrow? You know, Corbin Burns starting for the Brewers, Graham Ashcraft going for the Reds. Like, what's the lineup going to be like? You know, it's going to be a bunch of lefties against the righty, and And the Reds are like, oh, well, you know, so such and such DFA'd pitcher we DFA'd 5 days ago, cleared waivers, is going to AAA, yada, yada, yada. P.S., we picked up Joey Votto's option. Like what would be like the reaction, not just in the clubhouse, but like among Reds fans? Like how that would be like an earth shattering.
Yeah. I mean, I totally think so. I mean, it, you know, being around the city and stuff and still seeing the, you know, the reverence that the fan base here has for Joey Votto, it's, you know, it's not unlike one of like, it's like Barry Larkin. It's like, you know, I'm not going to say the other guy, but he's at that level.
Yeah.
At this point, yeah. with this current generation of fans, to where, you know, I think it'd be a huge just vitamin B12 shot in the arm.
Or like Joey Votto has restructured his contract and declined, both sides have declined their option for 2024 and have announced a 2-year, $20 million deal. Like, what, like that, like the reverberations that would have within the clubhouse would be just like, that's like, holy shit, like, boom, it's fucking on. Like, it would be, it's on for so many people. And it's like, it's not like the Reds are over-levered and overextended for next year. They've got Hunter Green under contract and Hunter Green under contract for next year. Like, it's not like they don't have the wherewithal and the ability to do something like that and still be as aggressive as they want to be. It seems like it's one of those things that should be a formality, even just from a respect standpoint, let alone the fact that the guy has shown that he is still one of the absolute elite hitters in baseball against right-handed pitching, which is who he would face 550 times a year. Somebody's going to give him that, and it should be the Cincinnati Reds. And I don't know. It seems like the longer they don't make a decision on that, when a guy has shown the dedication and the ability to warrant it, the more that's going to do harm to what the team's vibes are, as we've talked about earlier, as they push towards the end of the season, than it otherwise would, you know, because it seems very, very clear that Votto is not just going to be vital to whether or not this 2023 surprise Reds team can make a playoff push, but it also seems like he sure as hell is going to be a big part of what the 2024 Reds could be if they just decided to pick up the option and commit to him being the guy that he's been throughout the course of his career, which is a Hall of Famer. So I think we'll call time on it after that. I'm Wick. Thanks to R from BK for joining us again on Walks Will Haunt and the second half of a very, 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 very entertaining Cincinnati Reds season begins tomorrow with the Milwaukee Brewers once again, the back end of a roughly 6-game, 2-city series with them in town at Great American Ballpark and a former Cy Young Award winner and Corbin Burns on the mound against Graham Ashcraft. So I'm excited to be talking about the Reds, not just being relevant, but how they're going to have to be strategic and the moves they're going to have to make to stay relevant, because it's been a long time since they've had the opportunity to do both, and they're both sitting right on their plate. I hope they get aggressive, but I hope they also stay a little bit within their means, because we know that given their ownership group, there are means. So anyway, I'm Wick. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you guys next week.